Welcome to New Books in Human Rights. This is Jim Dawes, and today I'll be talking to Lidwine Kaptans, author of the new book, Clan Cleansing in Somalia, The Ruinous Legacy of 1991. It's an important book on an important topic, which approaches the recent history of Somalia from a range of perspectives, including deep political history and contemporary poetry. Thanks for being here today, Lidwine.
You're welcome.
So the first question I wanted to ask is if you had 3 minutes, let's say you're getting in an elevator with the person listening to this podcast, and you had 3 to 5 minutes to explain to them what this book is about, why they should read it, what would you say to them?
Well, what I would say is that Somalia has not had much attention since Black Hawk Down, the ruinous event of 1993, which was in the middle of the US-UN intervention in Somalia. But what I'm bringing out is a very important episode of large-scale violence against civilians that I believe triggered the collapse not just of the regime of the military dictator Mohamed Siad Barre, but also the state. And we will probably come back to this, but this included communal violence by civilians who knew their victims intimately. And therefore, for more than that reason, but that is one of the reasons why I think that this particular episode of violence is so important and has not been publicly acknowledged. So that is, I think, and so the book deals with only 2 years. And I will probably get a chance to talk to you more about why I stopped where I stopped and why I began where I began. But I think it is an episode of violence that caused so much distrust and so much pain that, and because it, and has not been acknowledged, that it underlies the ongoing contestations in Somalia, I think, in a very special and important way.
So one of the things you do is you identify 1991 and 1992, the Clan cleansing, and you identify it as a kind of key shift in the history of violence in Somalia. Can you say a bit more about what you mean by that?
Yes. Yeah, so this does get us, of course, into the history of Somalia. One of the things that I think before I start, I would say maybe just like in Iraq under Saddam Hussein, the military dictatorship that lasted from 1969 to 1991 is the cradle of many of the enormous problems that came after. And to begin with, two very large-scale incidents or episodes, I should say, of large-scale violence against civilians were done by the state. They were state-sponsored in 79 to 81, and then in the northwest in Hargeisa and Burro in 1988. And that one has received much attention. What one of the elements of the key shift is that until then, so by this cruel and violent military government, large-scale violence against civilians had been used against civilians it associated, because of their clan background, with new armed fronts. So the first armed front was in 1978. The first large-scale violence against civilians by the government is against the so-called clansmen of this front, right? It's already, of course, a war crime, or actually not a war crime. It's a... Well, it's large-scale violence against civilians because these people may have liked that front in their heart, but they were not guilty of anything. The second time the government does this in 1988, and the scale is enormously much larger, is in 1988 in what is now the Somaliland Republic, self-proclaimed Somaliland Republic. It was because the government punished people of the clan background it associated with another armed front, the Somali National Movement. The key shift comes that when Barre is expelled out of Mogadishu by another front, the United Somali Congress, that front actually splits into the middle. It welcomes into its leadership positions those high officials and henchmen of the Barre regime that are of their clan. And it persecutes, as Haradiga Siad, as Barre leftovers, Siad leftovers, those henchmen of the Barre regime who are of the wrong clan. However, it also targets 6, 7, 8 clans who are associated with Bharat's clan family. You see, so now a very, I don't know, you know, there's the number game, 25%, 30% of the civilians who have suffered from this military regime, like other Somalis, now become the target for terror warfare and expulsion from Mogadishu, from Beledweyne, from central and south central Somalia, all the way to Kismayo and the Kenyan and Ethiopian border. And that has not been talked about.
So one of the things that you mentioned in this respect is the label of genocide and how that may or may not apply here, and the problem of intent in thinking about this large-scale violence. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yes, you go kind of to the heart of the difficult questions. I have not used genocide. Now, we all know that the genocide definition of the UN is very problematic, and I'm glad we have it, but it is problematic in this sense. On the one hand, it's too narrow because it excludes, for example, groups that are targeted on the basis of their politics, like maybe in Latin America. And at the same time, it is too broad because a good-sized ethnic riot in Bombay could almost fall under the UN genocide definition. So I find that the reason I avoided it, because I worked a little bit with the definition of Alexander Laban Hinton, who includes at least the timeline, so how long, how big, and how far? So the range and the geographical range and the temporal range and the numbers. So because I realized that the people who were clans in Somalia were safe in Nairobi from their enemies, I thought that I didn't want to use genocide. Maybe I also didn't want to put genocide between Somali parties, although I guess that people find clan clenching already really, really a harsh term. I find it a harsh term myself. I wouldn't have chosen it if I thought it was something else. No. So I used clan clenching because I think, because I used the Commission of Experts in the context of former Yugoslavia. They talk about using terror warfare to make an area homogeneous. And that is impossible in the whole area that was being clan, but it was the intent in large parts of it, in particularly Mogadishu and the cities of Beledweyne, Baidaba, of let's say of the interriverine area, and that is and we really have no idea about the numbers. We think tens of thousands, but, you know, the woman who couldn't take her asthma medicine and who died, and the people who died of hunger and thirst on the way, and the people who got stuck between the Somali border and being allowed entrance in Kenya, the people who died because they capsized in overcrowded boats, those are also victims of it. So the number is numbers. I do not want to give a number, but it is really, really large. Intent, to begin with, of course, I wrote a book, probably interdisciplinary, but I wrote it as a historian. And so when I argue as a historian and not as a lawyer. I'm not standing in front of the International Criminal Court, right? So that's one. So the reason why I believe in intent is actually a set of reasons. So first of all, it is the chronology of how events follow each other. And I can give you, I don't know whether I should give you many examples because I think for the non-Somalists it's going to be hard to follow. So you can say that partly you have a chain of events, and the chain of events shows that there are events of large-scale violence against civilians, for example, in a city called Galkayo, which is close to the Ethiopian boundary, where a whole group of Hiraleal, they call them, of the shaved heads, the elders, were abducted and never to be seen again because they could have been a peace party. And that city was not on the way of chasing, for example, the dictator to the south. It is truly an excursion after they have already made their peace, after they have told Mogadishu they're going to be part of whatever national reconciliation meetings need to be done, and yet they're attacked. And they're attacked by USC Idit, General Idit of Black Hawk Down fame or notoriety. So the way that the events follow each other is one reason. Another important reason actually comes from a reading. I was very inspired by a scholar called Jacques Semelin, who has written about atrocities, and I think it was something about the vocabulary of atrocities. It's an article whose title would not immediately make you think of intent. And he said two things. He said, you know, if you don't have a Nazi archive, you know, where you can prove how they planned it and what they did, which you rarely have, because things such as clan cleansing and genocides, often they are being concealed as they are being executed. And this is true for Somalia in 1991. So he said, you rarely have that, and we don't have that for Somalia. He said, you have two other things. You have speech acts. And we have speech acts in Somalia. And I would love to talk a little bit more about narrative, since you are also a specialist in narrative later on. We have speech acts, which in context are meaningful. But again, not evidence, because, you know, I could go and stand here in the streets of Wellesley and say something about what I'm going to do. And if it came to pass in 3 weeks, you would still have to prove the connection between my speech act and what happens. So what Semelin said that really, really was important to me. He said, if you don't have the Nazi archives, for example, what you may have is a pattern of events, a pattern of how things were done, how the clan cleansing took place. And what I noticed in the stories that had been told to me about what happened to people when they were targeted, when they were collected by young, the Somalis called the Moriyan. So these are kind of the urban, you know, the kids who are armed and who actually do a lot of the violence. These stories, which I had come to me actually before the project of the book, from hindsight, after I had written them down, showed me the pattern. The stories were about the moment that an individual realized that, one, they were targeted on the basis of their clan background. Two, it was not random chaos. It was not just popular anger. There were actually top or intermediate commanders who were supervising this youth. And that was for them, and that was for them, and that was for me then also a evidence that there were patterns. There are many other reasons, and I would like to just say one more thing about those vignettes that came to me, because my project was largely not a memory project, which I actually think would be best done by Somalis from very many different backgrounds and from very honest intent. But those vignettes also showed me that many of those same individuals were saved by the very individual in whose name this clan cleansing was taken place. So, which is one of the reasons why we shouldn't talk about clan X did this to clans, you know, YZ, because we could not and we cannot distinguish, if we do that, between perpetrators, saviors, bystanders, and inciters, you know, organizers, if you wish. So intent for me, therefore, was the pattern that came out of the stories that came to me, as well as the way the events followed each other, or the atrocities or the episodes of atrocity followed each other. And there's a third one that I would like to mention to you. It is indirect, but I read a book by Mark Nishanian, or maybe Mark Nishanian, which is called The Historiographic Perversion. And Nishanian talks about that he finds it almost obscene that the Armenians in the genocide that followed or during and following World War I have to retell their story again and again and again, and it is never enough for the person who wants evidence. And so he says the historiographic perversion, at what point do we believe survivors? Now, I think that that is more relevant for the Armenians and more relevant for the Palestinians, maybe in 48, because there hasn't really been a memory project on the clan cleansing of 1981. But the vignettes that are included in the book, and there's only like 12 to 16 of them, I think should be taken seriously. And then,
you're mentioning these vignettes for people who haven't read the book yet. This is a highly analytical book, but it's also one that gives you a very close-up personal view of some of this history. Would you be willing to share one or two of those vignettes in this podcast?
So the vignettes are just a very small part of the book. It's less than 20 pages, I think. And they tell a brief story of how victims of this clan cleansing told this story, actually in most cases not to me, but to a relative or to a Somali person. And I was either there or it came to me through a brother or through a sister or through. So one of the stories it came to me too, although it was also first told to family. And this is of an older person who was a member of a manifesto group, which was a kind of a group of former civilian leaders and many others, but in this case, a former civilian leader who had twice was collected by these kind of young neighborhood thugs with a gun to his head. And twice he was saved by a kid who recognized him, who says, "Uncle, what are they doing to you?" Anyway, that is actually a vignette of how a member of the so-called perpetrating group, right, which is why I don't speak of perpetrating clans, but of armed fronts, in this case the USC, that individuals were targeted in the name of a clan but saved by individuals of that clan. A better example of intent would be the story in the vignette in the book is called What to Do with Aunt Miriam. And this is the story of a woman who was collected by neighborhood kids who knew her as Edo, which in this case, of course, is not really aunt, but a term used for a person of the other generation that you know well. So they take this person actually to Osman Ato, who has been the financier of the USC for a long time. And the kids bring her to his presence, and he says, and they say, "What should we do with Edo Marian?" And of course, once you call somebody Edo, it's really hard for a leader to say, "Hey, get rid of Edo, I'm a killer." So he said angrily, "Let her go." And before she is out of earshot, she hears him say to the kids, "Next time, don't bring a person like this to me. Take care of them on the spot."
This is difficult material. Can you tell us a little bit about how you came to this project and your process of writing the book?
So I had been really, you know, I don't want to say overworked at Wellesley, but we all have these moments that we have too much administrative work. So I had been probably further from my research than ever before. And the last book had been about Somali popular culture, about that glorious period of independence, which was a really a groundswell of really Somali support for this independence that they had finally found. And so I'd done something on pop songs, popular songs, which were really iconic for that period and an authoritative place to talk about the hopes and dreams of Somalis of that time. Now, so when I then had to write new grant proposals, I thought, okay, let me look at what popular songs said about this horrible civil war. And very quickly I realized that the popular songs were not an authoritative space for this violence, and that more authoritative was Somali poetry, and particularly a very prestigious kind of poetry done by men, for men almost, in the most prestigious male genres, in a way that could be performed in front of reconciliation meetings. So that could be performed in shared Somali space, public space, and not just, you know, for the clan only or for. And so when I began to read those, I found that they were amazing poems, amazing in the terms of the power of their description, amazing in the power of their analysis. Because these were not people who were going to blame clans, whole clans, for what happened. They did not attribute single agency to whole clans. But what they didn't do They couldn't say who did what to whom. And so the first stage of my research, in a sense, ended with me falling off my chair in the middle of the night, realizing they're not saying who did what to whom. And apparently in this space, they cannot. And then I said to myself, what do I really know about what really happened as the regime broke down and as then the state collapses? And that then made me into maybe a more conventional historian, and I found every source I promised you I could find, and I'm still finding some things, including written in Somali, you know, Italian, you mentioned it, news, spies, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So the first chapter of the book then deals with a variety of mediations, of representations that, of course, are also interventions that are literary. Then when I started to research, I was totally aware that the cradle of all this was the military regime itself. And so chapter two is about that, the increasingly violent nature of that regime, the increasingly violent clan divided rule of that regime, the undermining of the institutions of the state by this regime, and the two episodes of large-scale violence against civilians sponsored by this regime. And may I say, add to that, because this is so important from hindsight, that this was not a representative regime. So no clans were represented in this regime. But if you look at the individuals who played a role in this regime, there were individuals of all, practically all clan backgrounds. So the state, you know, as I argue in the book, although it was a state falling apart and a violent state, it was still shared by Somalis in very unequal and difficult ways, but still shared. So that part of the research is largely based on secondary sources, again, as many sources I could find, because two things: without the breakdown of the state, without the violence, the large-scale violence of against civilians perpetrated by the state, and without then when the dictator is expelled, the breakout of war. Who is it who said, Michael Mann, there is no genocide without war, right? So without the breakdown of law and order in Mogadishu, who knows whether this would have been possible? And so you have a horrible regime that becomes more and more violent. You have a front, armed front, UAC, that comes to Mogadishu and starts now singling out 6-7 clans, civilians, and henchmen of the regime in the context of a breakdown of law and order. So, for example, one important aspect of this, again, let me backtrack 1 minute. A civil war is always many civil wars, right? So from regional resource conflicts to even once it is happening, personal little vendettas, like you took my girlfriend when we were in high school, to, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Opportunity with impunity, in Rwanda called genocide business, of course, all of that then begins to play in making this possible. So I really contextualize it with the regime, chapter two, and then in chapter three, what is actually happening in the month leading up and following, you know, the takeover of this clans in the Mogadishu.
You asked two important questions in your book that I'd like to ask you again here. First, what were the political goals of the military and political entrepreneurs who used clan-based violence? And second, what was it that propelled ordinary civilians to join in the militias and participate in this clan cleansing?
All right. Yeah. So you really ask for all the arguments in the book. It's always very hard, of course, to do justice to the full argument. The political goals, I think source on the Barre regime is a dissertation in French that hasn't been published yet, but is available to interlibrary loan by Daniel Compagnon. And so for the regime, he argues that the Barre dictator has the same goals all along, but that his methods become more and more violent. And so for the dictator, he wants to be the only one who's in charge. And because he after the war against Ethiopia, his position is very, very much weaker. He uses more and more violence in order to stay on top. The other thing he does really from the beginning, that he does the clan divide and rule. He will lift up, you know, one group to put down another group, and he has his wrists on kind of the grievances and the stories that circulate in groups about how these guys got one up over us, right? And this group. And so the clan divide and rule of that regime is a tool for the dictator to stay on top. And I'm going to be facetious on purpose, add a little bit of large-scale violence against civilians to your clan divide and rule, and you get what Donald Donnan has said, you know, you harden those clan-based identities like never before. Donald Donham says nothing will primordialize a group identity more, or harden, he means, than violence, than when you are targeted for violence in the name of the group you belong to. Right? So that is so for Bada, it means stay on top, don't share with anybody, and since you can't take on everybody at the same time, keep everybody destabilized. He therefore becomes also an important cause of the clan cleansing, because his own family, which of course a small group within his clan, is very much hated in Somalia when he begins to totally undermine and, you know, the institutions of the state. And so because he himself wants to make sure that it's not his family and therefore his clan that gets targeted, he also begins to try to organize the civilian population in two camps, the camp that later becomes, you know, the camp that is constructed in the genealogical construct of Ir Nimmo, Hawiya Nimmo, and then the Darod Nimmo. The Darod become the target of the clan cleansing campaign. He plays a role in that because he's trying to set them up too, right? So, and of course, the other thing is he doesn't leave Mogadishu when he could have and before all of this happened. So it is to stay on top alone. The front that enters into Mogadishu, what was expected really until days before this happens in Mogadishu by people in the diaspora, by many people in Mogadishu, that this person say, hey, we liberated the country from this dictator. Now let all armed fronts based and all people of all clan backgrounds, let's now rebuild together. We are free from this dictator. But what happens instead is that, you know, this part of the civilians are now associated with the regime, while this other part are not. And they've all been suffering. So what is then the goal of this front, or at least the leaders of this front? Two things. For one thing, you can say that they have been mobilizing the rural young men, well, not only young men in the interior, with the narrative of all the wealth of Mogadishu belongs to these Darod. We're going to kick the dictator out of the Darod dictator out of Mogadishu, and all the wealth of Mogadishu is going to be ours. So these guys are hard to stop. Yeah, and the people actually who argue against intent will make that argument. And I actually agree with them that this is one thing that happened. But the other thing is, why did the leader of a USCID, why did he not open it up to the other armed fronts? He was on top. He would have been on top. So what is he thinking? He wants to be a Barra-like, as yet a dictator-like person, but he's not willing to compete with the other armed fronts, most of which were much longer established than his front. Right? He even competes with USC Mogadishu, the leader of the other branch of his army that actually had been in Mogadishu all the time as he was approaching from Ethiopia. So he just really doesn't want to include those people too, we find out later. So this is so amazingly, it is horrific, but it's also really interesting because once you organize, once you don't have a cause, and once you organize yourself on the basis of who is the right clan, you cannot invite people on board anymore, right? Like if I'm a Maoist and I'm trying to persuade the rural population to join me, they can at least say they're Maoist and they might be part of my group. But if I say I'm organizing people of these clans, right, to attack people of those clans, then of course the people of those clans can no longer join. They can only be expelled. They can only, or they can, in the areas that they're a majority, maybe be what the Somalis called ra'iya, yeah, subjects. And so, but the goal is to be alone on the top without competing with the leaders of the other armed fronts, even with, you know, your with the leader of UIC Mogadishu, United Somali Front, sorry, USC Mogadishu, which is the same front. So I'm going to try to answer the questions about why the actual perpetrators do what they do. And so I think what the book tries to do is to create as full a context as possible in the factors that it mentions. So the breakdown of the state in different parts of Somalia, regional conflicts over resources, personal vendettas, opportunity with impunity, the breakdown of law and order. So the context of something like clan cleansing is multidimensional and includes war. But I think what the book brings that is new is what were the discursive triggers? How were the perpetrators at that moment when it mattered persuaded to participate in terror warfare and expulsion? And here I am using the concept of somebody called Ben Lieberman, who has written about former Yugoslavia. And he coined the concept of mythical, he calls it national, I'm going to call it mythical group hate narrative. In Somali context, it will be mythical clan hate narrative. And I'm going to talk a little bit about what I mean with that and then say why this is relevant to Somali. So Somalis have a long history. And I think that what feeds into clan hate narratives, so hate narratives that people talk about other clans, narrate about other clans, has a lot to do with differential elite formation. So what did the colonial, what were the colonial policies towards different groups in Somalia? And also historical contingency. Who happened to be the wireless boy for the British military administration and learned some English, right? So some of this was policy and some of this was historical contingency. And so these hate narratives are about grievances of the past. And many groups have reasons for grievances of the past. Probably most groups have a grievance about the past. The question is, how do they get processed into a hate narrative? And they get processed, so these hate narratives are about grievances. And they are, the first correct characteristic you can say is, they are based on fact and fiction. There is enough fact to make people really believe them. But they're fictional because they get spun now into a lethal charge. And so one is they're about grievances. Two is they are being presented, so they're based on the past and facts and fiction. They are being presented as about the core of this group identity, wiping out other identities that people have in that group, like neighbors and playing soccer together or working together or living together in Mogadishu and all that, being even interrelated by marriage. Yeah? This hate narrative spins now this story as this is about the core of our group. It also, if we don't act now, our group will not be powerful at the hour of victory. If we don't act now, they will get the better of us once again. That's the mythical part. So the mythical part is about a particular spinning of the past, right? That has some fact, but a lot of fiction. And then the mythical part of it is that it spins this past and this centrality to identity in such a way that the mythical time of the group past and what is needed for the group present overwhelms everyday time, everyday relations, the fact that we're neighbors, the fact that we drink coffee together, the fact that yesterday you had the key to my house, remember, from former Yugoslavia, right? And so it is this kind of mythical hate narrative that is based on fact and fiction that spun in this Somali context into very persuasive, and by the way, not only for uneducated rural folks or uneducated kids from the urban bidonville or slums, but also for intellectuals, for middle-class people who actually came to look for their friends by name, right? So that hate narrative, that becomes a discursive trigger in a situation that is multi-level and that has truly, you know, breakdown of the state, lack of salary. I mean, all the things that I try to explain in the book and that I probably cannot fully list here.
Given this history of clan cleansing and given what you understand about the logic of clans in Somalia, tell us a bit about your expectations about how this is working out now and how it will work out in the near-term future in Somalia.
So this is so in a sense, before I explain to you how I got to the project through the literature, and then I explained that when I found out that the prestigious poets couldn't say who did what to whom, that then I did the second part of the project was to document this, to go and document it as a historian, not as a lawyer, and to describe really empirically how it happened. Of course, also analytically. But the third part, once I did that, I said to myself, oh my God, how am I going to bring this in the present and not make things worse? Or what could I do? On the one hand, I really think this story needs to be told. But how could I tell it in such a way that if people really are open to reading this and to thinking about this, I would not be redrawing the lines, the same battle lines now, you know, with the pen. And so the whole third part of the project then actually became trying to read up of all the people who had written about this, whether it's particularly, actually, I must say, I drew on the literature on Rwanda and former Yugoslavia, which were the most recent examples of large-scale violence. And so I have three, I think, elements of my approach that I tried to bring out and that I keep repeating also to Somalis, you know? And one is that please do not attribute single agency to clans. Clans did not kill. People killed in the name of clan. That's a big difference, because if you don't make that difference, the organizers and inciters, the perpetrators, the bystanders, and the saviors cannot be distinguished. And this, I think, Somalis understand, you know, the victims understand that certainly. One, having said that, and you probably, many of you will remember the book by Mahmoud Mamdani, When Victims Become Killers. Let's not attribute single agency to clans. At the same time, try to understand why so many people flocked to the banner of clan and killed in the name of clan. And I have tried to do that throughout the book, both in the material circumstances and with the discursive triggers, the mythical hate narratives that I just talked about. But so that's one. Two, then I said, please, can we not take for granted those mythical hate narratives? Because they are actually still circulating. And as long as we keep repeating those as truth, then we will keep thinking the way the clan clans are thought. That's the second one. The third one then is what I already, in a sense, said to you, make clan matter and not matter at the same time. We know this about race. We know this about sex or gender, if people are more used to that term, right? So let me use the example of women. Women know they don't want to be reduced to womanhood, to their sex, to their gender. And at the same time, they know they have to keep their eyes on the sexism out there. And they have to realize that sexism is an incredible, powerful tool to put them down. So that was the third one, make clan matter and not matter at the same time. So that's one thing that I've tried to do. The other thing that we haven't talked about, Jim, is that I do in the book. Not only is there a whole chapter about Barra and how the clan clansing would not have been unthinkable without the actions of the Bashar regime. I also have, and it makes really for a long and empirical chapter, chapter three, once the gland cleansing gets going, there are a number of clan-based militias that join in the clan cleansing. And there is therefore immediately what I call a war of the militias. A war of the militias becomes a competition between warlords of all kinds, also the warlords who now are reorganizing militias from among the victims of the clan cleansing, and they fight each other. The Darod-based comebacks. So some of the henchmen of the Bashar regime now recruit militias from among the victims who survive. And they come back to Mogadishu, committing atrocities against civilians. Right? And I document those too. They do not get as much space because nobody has denied those. And they have been documented to some extent. I'm not saying that those victims are less important than the victims of the clan cleansing. What I'm trying to show is that there is a connection between them, and there is one that hasn't been talked about. But I really do document, therefore, that part of civil war violence that is not only done by the perpetrators of the clan cleansers, but is done by those who organize the victims of the clan cleansers and come back and try to come back to Mogadishu. You see, so that is also, if you look at the narrative then, that there is balance there. Yeah, I'm not saying like, hey, I don't call you a clan, but I only document your violence. No. So one thing that I also tried to do in the book, and actually it explains why I stop in December 1992. So I really start with the Bashar regime, but I start the story when the violence breaks out in Mogadishu in June 89, and I take the story up to December 1992. Why do I do that? I'm trying to prove that clan and clan hatred is an instrument for mobilization, and therefore a powerful one that does engage a popular mindset and manipulates a popular mindset. So I stop in 1992 because by that time, if the USC, the front that marched on Mogadishu and expelled Bashar from Mogadishu, was based on a clan alliance that was genealogically constructed as Hawiye Nimmo or Irre Nimmo, the Hawiye clan, or Irre Nimmo, the brings in a few more clans into that level of genealogical descent, if you wish. You see that breakdown in Mogadishu in November, really in April, but in November 1991. The two branches of this United Somali Congress actually start a war. And people believe that 14,000 people were killed as these people who had fought in the name of a particular clan construct, now that clan construct implodes and militias fight in the name of a sub-form of that construct, right? So it's not in the end about clan, right? It's how you use it for power. Now, among the victims of the clan cleansing, which include organizers which were henchmen of the Bashar regime, who struck back in the name of a construct of Darod Nimmo, the Darod clan family, in December 1990, in December 1992, which is just as the Belgians have already landed in Kismayo or are about to land in Kismayo, which is the southern city, and the U.S. has already landed in Mogadishu, a Darod-based warlord kills 120 or more civilian elders who also belong to one of the clans of the Darod clan family. So that clan construct also implodes because warlords are competing with each other and kill civilians in the name of a subconstruct, right? And this ending in Kismayo is so significant, I think, because I see it as a stage in the Klan cleansing, because the IDIT, the head of the OSCE, had just visited Gizmayo the night before. I see it as a stage in warlord violence, where they use Klan-based militias to compete with each other and use violence against civilians to get one up over each other. And finally, and I think this is so important to the book, it shows that warlords, when they used large-scale violence against civilians, were always also destroying alternatives to their own projects. Yeah, once you have provoked or you have caused large-scale violence against civilians, how are people, if somebody killed for you, how is she going to step away from you? And if somebody was killed by you because of who they are, how are they now going to look for a peaceful? You know, it takes a long time then for them to find a peaceful alternative. So in Gizmayo, you know, there were 120 middle-class elders who would have been the peace party, who would have been the preferred discussion partners for the Belgians and for the U.S. if they, once they landed, were now wiped out. And I'll end with an anecdote. Robert Oakley, who was, of course, the U.S. ambassador, who was the spokesman, special envoy of Bill Clinton. Sorry, it is Bush, George Bush at that time. You know, they asked him and said, Ambassador Oakley, what are you going to do about this large-scale violence, you know, the killing of all these civilian middle-class elders in Gizmayo? He said, well, sorry, guys, this is not part of our mandate. Because this is not what the Security Council asked the UN-US intervention to do. And then he says, really, I don't know, either stupidly or cynically, by the way, don't worry, we will develop an alternative civilian leadership. And that leadership, of course, has just been wiped out in that city. So you see, I really try to not just tell the story of one clan-based militia conducting a clan cleansing. I really try to give a wider context. Now, my final comment then, how is this falling in the Somali community? I think that from the sides of the victims, they are grateful it's in the open. And when I asked them, but why did so few of you write about it? I think that they were waiting for effective speech. When they were kicked out, when they ended up in the refugee camps, by November, so this happens in December, January, March, May, right? By November, this violence is happening between two branches of the OSCE in Mogadishu, and all kind of other Somalis also end up in the refugee camps. So whose shoulders are they going to cry? My violence is more important than their violence. They were busy surviving. They were busy building up their life. And to some extent, they feel that their survival is their talking back. And they always talk about our houses in Mogadishu, right? So yes, and sometimes I think so they are grateful and they are happy and they have begun their own ways of commemorating and of working with this that are actually not attached to my book. Among the people who associate themselves by descent with the USE, I think it's very hard for this to be raised, partly because I think it has been actively concealed also, by the way, Jim, by our very colleagues in the field and some of people you know very well. And I think our people who listen to this program know well. And I initially was very upset about this. And then I realized this is what civil wars do, right? So when I get some hate mail, when I get some things on the website that say I'm simply biased and I'm only against this clan, if you read the book, I think I wrote it better than that. Whether I wrote it well enough is always a question, right? But it is not written as, you know, another outsider taking the side of one particular group of Somali, which, as you know, is so easy to do in this field, but much harder to do in 2013. So I hope that it will start a real conversation and not just sniping and trying to put me down or to put a book down, and that at some point people, you know, what I have said to people is, when Somalis are ready to talk about it, mine is just a history book. It cannot be better than the sources it uses. And so, but when Somalis sit down to talk about it, I hope the book will sit in the corner of that table someplace, because all narratives need to be on the table when we talk about the future. But not all narratives are equally valid about the past. And that is where I hope the book for the future maybe could play some role. Thank you.
I think it will. This is important work, and thank you so much for sharing it with us.